With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to Your Own Personal Beatles with me, Robin Allender.
And me, Jack Belling.
How's it going, Jack?
It's good. I'm glad we said hello the other way around this
week.
Yeah,
it's very disorientating.
To change things up.
Took me three goes.
But now I'm wondering what's going on. I'm like, yeah, oh, yeah. I'm fine.
Good.
I was wondering whether I'm you or not. No, I'm good. I've been enjoying some of this sort of special John Lennon 80th programming over the last week.
Yeah.
And looking forward to tucking into this episode with comedy legend Kevin Eldon and Jem Roberts, the author of the forthcoming book Fab Fools, The Last Ever Untold Beatles Story. And it's a fun one.
It was really fun, and it was incredibly nerve-wracking. You know, if you think Kevin Eldon is a big comedy hero, you know, we've been watching for like over 20 years on TV...
You know, if for some reason you've never seen a British comedy, and are unaware of who Kevin Eldon is, he has starred in basically everything that's good. He's almost a kind of seal of approval, really.
Yeah.
Starting with sort of Leon Herring, going through into Alan Partridge, Brass Eye, Big Train, Spaced, Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, and also his own The Kevin Eldon Show and his stand. He also did stand-up, really good stand-up show as well. In Edinburgh a few years ago, which has got my friend Toby, one of his favourite ever lines, which is Kevin Eldon talking about going to drama school, and all it taught him was how to go, "I'm somebody else," which is really good.
Brilliant.
It was one of my faves. But it was kind of hard because it's a Beatles podcast. I felt very conscious. I didn't want to do too much kind of fanboying, and I can't believe now I didn't even mention Chris Morris.
Yeah, but, I know. There was just so much Beatles stuff to talk about and so much to get into in the book, which Kevin has written the foreword to.
Yeah.
We did touch on Big Train and his absolutely amazing George Martin impression that I'm sure... We should just say at the top of the show that we do talk about that because lots of people have tweeted us asking if we're going to talk to him about his George Martin impression.
You can't not, you know.
Yeah, and we've very slyly put it right at the end, so you have to listen to the whole thing. But it's worth sticking around for.
Jem Roberts is an absolute delight as well, and his book is genuinely fantastic. It's absolutely brilliant. I really loved reading it. And it was just great to chat to such a comedy expert and music expert. So it was a very good episode, I thought.
And as he mentioned, you know, there is no shortage of Beatles books, but this one really had something new to say. And it's amazing that the sort of Beatles in comedy angle has never really been explored to this sort of degree.
Yeah.
And we recorded it a few weeks ago. And it actually feels like years ago because I read the book, I finished the book, sunbathing in the park, which now seems like about 6 years ago.
Well, before the episode, I read the whole Beatles bit and you read the whole Ruttles bit. So combined, we had read it in total.
Yeah, full transparency.
Indeed.
Yeah, it was good, but it's a fascinating read. And it is out on the 30th of October and you can pre-order it now.
Yeah.
So we'll be getting onto that in a little bit. We've got a bit of correspondence to do. We should just mention that you haven't had the chance to hear it yet, but Radio 2 over the weekend, I just said Radio 2 in a very Radio 2 way. Radio 2 over the weekend had some special programming for John Lennon's 80th birthday, which is coming up this Friday, in which Sean Ono Lennon interviews Elton John, his godfather and pal of 1970s John Lennon, and he also talks to Julian Lennon in a really sort of moving, in-depth conversation, and then there's a fantastic interview with Paul on there as well, which is also very sort of touching. So highly recommend them. And we had a couple of covers. We talked Beatles covers a few times on the podcast.
Yeah.
But if you go to our Twitter feed, Mae Martin got in touch to say that she hates 99% of Beatles covers, but she sent a really nice version of Martha, My Dear, on banjo and guitar by a YouTube channel of someone called The Other Favourites, who I'd not heard of, which started quite a fun thread about Beatles covers, and a fantastic one from another former guest, Johnny White, who sent in Ghost's version of Here Comes the Sun. Have you ever heard that?
No, I haven't. I mean, this, I've been off Twitter, and it sounds like it's got really good since I left.
No, I mean, it was a rare chink of light in the
because I logged back on today, and it's
quagmire.
Lawrence Fox wall-to-wall, and it's just like, oh, I'm logging off again. But it sounds like I've been missing some fun stuff.
No, it's really good. That Ghost one is particularly good. And Johnny said, I used to listen to this one walking around the heath and imagine a trailer for some sort of supernatural thriller about 1980s London. Still think it would be a good film. Sadly, no proper detail ever emerged.
That's great.
But if that film ever comes out of development hell, then I would definitely be the first one to buy a ticket.
In the Twitter thread was the Breeders' cover of Happiness is a Warm Gun mentioned, because that is really good.
That's a cracker. We should do a little Spotify playlist of our favourite Beatles covers, actually, because I keep meaning to sort of send some around. But, trawl through back our Twitter. You can follow us on social media at Personal Beatles if you want some more gold. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and all that good stuff.
Soundgarden covered Come Together, and I like it, but some people don't.
I don't think I've ever heard that.
It's good.
All right. I know what I'm going to listen to after this. Great stuff.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of housekeeping. I'm actually moving house in a couple of weeks. Literal housekeeping. And I've got some surplus Your Own Personal Beatles mugs, which are absolutely fantastic. They look really cool. They come in a very special box, and they usually are given to guests of the show to say thank you for coming on. But we have some spare ones. I don't want to take them with me. So if you would like one, then it is yours for a donation to the upkeep of the podcast. If you hate receptacles or don't like tea or coffee...
You hate us.
If you like us, but you don't want
a mug... If you hate us, you could buy a mug, fill it with hot tea, and then splash it all over us.
Yeah, smash it in anger.
Yeah.
Stamp around on our porcelain faces. But if you do enjoy the show and you want to contribute, but you don't want a mug for whatever reason, you can go to personalbeatles.com/donate. And thank you again to everyone who's done it this week. It's really, really helpful. We're coming to the end of this season, and we would... Season or series? What should we call it?
Series.
Series, come on. Rule Britannia.
Speaking of mugs, my friend who is a mug, Sam Healy, you said you wanted a mug, but you never got in touch. So can you pull your ass out of your head?
Yes, okay, I'll hold it for you. First come, first serves on those ones. You can see a picture of them on our Instagram page. If you enjoy the show and you want to get in touch with us, then you can go to personalbeatles.com/contact or email me jack@homespunsounds.com, just like these lovely people did. So I'll read out a little bit of correspondence. First one is from Ben Taylor, who says, "Hi guys, I hope you're staying sane. Your podcast is certainly helping me to do so. Speaking of how far-reaching the Beatles' influence is, I thought you might be interested in a fact that blew my mind. On a trip to the Science Museum in London, I discovered that EMI actually funded the research for the subsequent invention of the CT scan due to the success of the band. I've attached an article below, which is very interesting. Would you like to hear the crux of this article?
Yeah. That's incredible.
It's an amazing story that starts with a guy called Godfrey Hounsfield, a researcher at EMI back in the 1950s. Although it was a somewhat struggling major label today, EMI, which stands for Electrical and Musical Industries, was once an industrial research company. Hounsfield did some pioneering work on computers, helping to build the first all-transistor computer, but the division wasn't profitable for EMI, and the company sold its computer business in 1962. So far... So boring.
It sounds like Lord Sugar. Sounds like Alan Sugar's about
Amstrad.
To...
Amstrad. In 1962, right when it signed the Beatles, his standing was good enough with the company that they let him conduct independent research with funding from the Beatles' strings of massive successes in the 1960s. He went on to invent the CT scanner, which EMI released in 1972, and shared the 1979 Nobel Prize for Medicine for his invention.
Wow. That's incredible, isn't it?
So next time you have a CT scan... just remember that Love Me Do probably paid for it.
Mm. In fact, CT is short for come together.
That's true. Mm. Little known fact.
Yeah. The Soundgarden version.
Yeah. Certainly not the Michael Jackson version of history, which is strange. Mm. But if it's free to cover because you've stolen the rights, why not make the most of it? Yep. We've got another email from Glenn Beattie here, who says, I thought I'd drop you a line to say thank you and Robin for the podcast. You're very welcome.
Oh, that's
I
really
only
nice.
Discovered it when you interviewed Hazel Wilde, and that was a great interview. I've been a big fan of Hazel and Lantern since their first album, which I stumbled upon on CD in a local record shop in Newcastle. Not Newcastle upon Tyne, but Newcastle, Australia.
Whoa.
I remember having an exchange with Hazel after Beings came out where we talked about the mixing, and I was disappointed that the vocals were mixed so low, and this was a shame because she wrote such great lyrics. Mm. Rectified on this album, as discussed in last week's podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I like both, but there's definitely a progression sometimes with artists where they kind of sort of wade out of the reverb to become more direct, I think.
Yeah. John Lennon did... we had to be coaxed out of that many times. He says, I've enjoyed the Beatles for most of my life and have listened to them from when I was perhaps 6 or 7 years of age. I'm now nearly 60. My much older brother was a fan and would buy their records. And when he died a couple of years ago, his vinyl collection came to me. And some of the hundreds of records that I'm most proud now to own are original Australian release Parlophone mono albums of Beatles for Sale, with the Beatles, Revolver and Help. When I bought my first CD player just over 30 years ago, I bought most of the studio albums on CD, and now, of course, they are on my streaming services. It's been interesting watching the technology, and I will be listening to things much differently when I am 64 than when I first heard the Beatles in a little coal mining town in Australia in the mid-60s.
Oh, that's so nice.
And he sent a picture of one of the original record sleeves there from, I think it's from Beatles for Sale, which is... this crazy yellow cover I've never seen before. But thank you so much for sending that in. That's great to hear.
Yeah, thank you.
So on with the show. We'll be back at the end to tell you who we've got coming on next week. But for now, enjoy Kevin Eldon and Jen Roberts. This week, we got an absolute treat. Robin and I are absolutely delighted to be joined by the author of upcoming book about the Beatles, Fab Fools, and the legendary comedian Kevin Eldon, who has written the foreword for the book. Hi, guys. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. It's lovely to be here.
Hello.
How are you guys doing? How's your strange lockdowns been?
Well, I am just embarrassingly grateful, to be honest, Kevin, because it's nice to meet you at last. Because
likewise.
The thing is, this was Kevin's show, and he kindly pointed out that this bloke had a book out, which he's written a fantastic forward
for. So you've never met before?
Chatted in all sorts of ways, but this is the closest we've got to having a drink together so
nice.
Far.
Oh, amazing.
Cool. Yes.
But so the thing is, I would listen to a podcast about Kevin Eldon's personal journey with the Beatles, no problem. So I'm basically getting it live, and I'm quite happy to be pulled out of the box at any stage needed, really. But it's so wonderful to be here, you know.
Well, you know, this book's great. We'll get onto the book, I'm sure, in some detail.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to get behind it in any possible way I can, because it's good to publicise stuff and get it out there. Because having read it, I would love Beatles fans to have a look themselves, because it's an interesting angle on the Beatles to look at. And my lockdown was... well, it was a Shangri-La, actually. Me and my family headed out of Stinktown, or London, as it's all sometimes called, as lockdown happened. And we went into the country to my mother-in-law's house, and we just stayed there, surrounded by fields, and I got a couple of kids, so we've got a fairly small flat in London, and we didn't want to be there during lockdown, so we actually had quite a nice time, yeah. Which seems wrong, but no, it seems wrong, but we did. We had a right old laugh, but we're back in London now.
Excellent. Lovely stuff.
Gems. Yeah, I loved the book. I think it was brilliant. And yeah, my first thought reading it was, why don't you think this story, this angle, has been told before in terms of the Beatles and comedy?
Well, then we get into the whole philosophy of writing about comedy at all, yeah. Don't we? Because that's been my patch for sort of 12, 13 years, and it's a very difficult patch to tend. So the only reason I do it is because I'm such a comedy anorak that I just had this horrible premonition that somebody was going to do a book on I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue, and I loved that show so much, I just thought, nobody else is allowed to screw this up.
Yeah.
And so that's the angle I was coming from with this, and everything I've done since, The Blackadder and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and Fry and Laurie, it's all just the stuff I love that I want to sort of keep safe and make sure it's done right. Mm. And the Ruttles, and I'm sorry, Having a Clue, have a kinship, really, in the kind of make-believe that makes them work.
Mm.
So I can go back. I mean, this book has been going on for so long, the whole last decade, basically. I mean, in 2011, I was able to write a letter to George Martin and get a reply. So that's how long it's been going
Amazing.
On now.
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird to look back and see how early on in my career, if we can call it that, in the words of David Bowie, how early on in my career that I suddenly realised, I think it's because I'd done Clue and I'd done Blackadder, and these were two of the biggest titans in the British comedy world.
Mm.
And so I was thinking, wow, I'm dealing with some pretty big things here, and what is the biggest thing in entertainment?
Mm.
And obviously, I've got at least about 8 foot worth of Beatles books, obviously, on my shelves.
Amazing.
I just looked up and saw that and thought, far too many of them already, aren't there? But that was, and so it's just the two of them coming together, really, was the real genesis of just thinking, hang on. I mean, I always thought, actually, with the anthology, for instance, people listening to the anthology all around the world back in the 90s, they think, what did Americans, obviously, but also Abyssinians and Tasmanians, what did they make of Morecambe and Wise? In what context were they listening to that fantastic stuff?
Yeah.
And similarly, as a British person, I'd heard the stories about John and the Smothers Brothers and everything, and I'd always just thought, well, who the hell are the Smothers Brothers? They never made it over here. And it sounded like there was some kind of cheesy Little and Large kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because why else would even drunk John, you know, heckle that show? But actually, they were really cool kind of folksy performers. And I don't know anything about them. So I've written the book. I always write the books for myself. There's no other reason to ever write a book.
Hmm.
But also just thinking, this is a whole area of knowledge which nobody's touched.
Yeah.
And that's an absolute crime. Yeah. And what it also comes back to in doing this job is people keep dying.
Mm.
So the more things you can do to try and celebrate this stuff while people are vertical men and women is really what I do this for.
Yeah.
I noticed, Jem, I haven't got a clue. You reduced to clue. So I think you should do that with all of your projects, down to one syllable. So Blackadder should come down to duh. And let's refer to the Beatles from now on as Tulls.
Tulls. Tulls. Might get confused with Ruttles.
That's true, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, so bees.
Bees and Ruz.
Bees and Ruz.
So, Kevin, when did you first realise that the bees were funny?
Well, I think I've covered this in the foreword a bit, actually. I just remember the films starting to be played on telly in the early 70s, and that's when I was at school. So, and they always used to come on at Easter holidays. It always seemed to be the Easter holidays. And I'd never seen Hard Day's Night at the Pictures, and I hadn't seen Help at the Pictures. And I loved them. I thought they were just so funny and interesting, and the music was great, of course. And Hard Day's Night particularly, I just was immediately taken by just that swank they had, and the smart sassing talk really got me, and Help as a little kid I liked because it was quite sort of cartoony, and then so that was my introduction to it, but I don't think I picked up on the nuanced layers of their wit, particularly yeah. Lennon, until I really got into the Beatles properly as a teenager. And then I'd started seeing that they were just brilliant. They were just kind of amazingly kind piss takers.
Yeah.
That's been an element of them that has always been almost as attractive to me as the music.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. I think the thing that I was struck from reading Jem's book is this idea that, you know, we have the records, and the records are records, you know, they're permanent in our culture, whereas a lot of stuff they did in the 60s was kind of ephemera, like Panto, like TV appearances that people forgot to tape or things like this, or, you know, the Christmas flexi discs. And so the great thing about the book is that, you know, you're kind of retrieving all that, the stuff that maybe people didn't know about, and showing that there's this whole other side of the Beatles where they're partaking in culture and, you know.
But is it really a bad thing that we don't have on record the Beatles performing Arctic Panto with Jimmy Savile? What would we do with that now?
Did apart that happen?
Jimmy Savile played the Yeti, yes, in a kind of an Everest sketch, I think, in their second and last.
There are quite
Panto
a lot of bits
show.
In your book where it's parenthesis, now disgraced, correctly.
Yeah, I thought I'd work that in, yeah. It was too inevitable, really.
Yeah.
There were almost too many.
But there was George Martin always used to say that about the period where they didn't have the control over what they released, that I think he said anything else that was be released should come with a health warning. Because right. There was just, you know, they'd literally just piled everything out. But you're right. I mean, especially sort of those sort of Christmas records. And then even later on when you talk about the Rasmus, I mean, how much is YouTube a sort of resource when you're digging back through all that stuff?
We live in a world with YouTube and Wikipedia. Mm. I mean, it's weird to look back and say I started out, you know, I started writing my first book in 2007, where they weren't quite as developed, you know, Internet 2.0 as then. But it's like anything else. You wouldn't take anything off Wikipedia unless you also had the book on it somewhere and could double check everything that you use. It is double checking stuff and name drop. But when I first started doing this book, I thought, right, there are too many Beatles books. But the one exception, obviously, we make to that is Mark Lewis' own. And I got to speak to him, and he kind of. We were talking about Tolkien and the whole story of Tolkien turning down the Beatles for Lord of the Rings because he had a rock band that lived next door that were always noisy, and so he hated rock music, and that's why he refused to do it. And Mark pointed out that that's probably bollocks, really. So we put in allegedly, at least. It's a good story. You always have a good story, but make sure if it's not absolutely cast iron, then that you've covered your arse on that.
Yeah. It's quite Partridge-y, that, not liking rock music. Yeah, that's great. Mm.
It's a shame that there's not a lot of the stuff that they had between them available to us. You know, it's a shame that their private lives are not ours. You know, it's a terrible thing to say, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know exactly. How dare they have private lives? But I mean, a lot of what we see about them being funny has a certain element of self-consciousness, because it's either written by somebody else, not so much, or they are in an interview situation. An example of that is, which I brought up with Jem as well, and he was well aware of, is there's quite a famous in Beatles circles tape of them goofing around in the studio during the recording of Think for Yourself. They just left the tape on, and I think it's George and Paul and John standing around a mic. You know, I don't think they were doing they're doing the backing vocals, and I don't think they were, you know, single tracking it like all the cowards do these days. They were just standing around, you know, fingers and ears, and they're waiting for the inevitable enormous complicated thing of, you know, getting the tape back to the right place, because I don't know, we're working on four track then, so it wasn't easy. It wasn't as easy as it would be now, sort of digitally. And they're relaxed and in a very good mood. I suppose it's 65, and everyone's just, you know, kind of having quite a laugh. And they are hilarious. They are absolutely hilarious. They're just like saying what the hell comes into their heads.
And it's all improvised and like,
why, you know, such fervour?
Yeah.
Why such fury?
They're all here, and I'll tell you, brethren, there's more of them than there are of us. And that's why there's so few of us left. Why such fury? Condemned out the thoughts of man.
Yeah. What is this wrath that beholds you?
Why such favour? Why such favour?
Okay, let's go.
And he called and they bloody well come.
Why? Yes, but if you look in your Bible...
I can't go on, I really can't. Come on, let's do this bleeding record.
Like you make a good point in the book that that's almost the Beatles at their funniest, you know, that when it's kind of freewheeling and doing little bits, and they're quite, you know, it's quite stoned humour as well, isn't it? They're kind of
been for a shit, have we, Megan? this is the thing. I've got to admit. I mean, I'm glad that you've enjoyed the book. It means the world to me, and it's good to bring all this stuff together and tell the story and everything. But I didn't get to interview Paul or Ringo for this book, and. I honestly thought I stood a good chance.
Yeah.
You know, I'm no great celeb. I'm no James Corden, no matter what anyone may say. But,
well, that's probably a good thing in most.
Anyway, but I thought if I could get through to them and say, look, everyone always talks about your private lives. They talk about the music. I want to talk about the comedy. They're Scousers. Mm. Why wouldn't they want to talk about comedy from all sorts of different angles? Mm. But I got a reply from Paul's office saying, this sounds interesting. Tell us more about it. And I did, and I never heard anything again.
Right.
And Ringo's just sort of an impregnable kind of Dr. Robotnik flying around, impossible to get near.
Right,
but those are the questions I would have asked. Who was Megan? Right. Who was Megan, and why such fervour?
Yeah.
You know, these are stuff we need to know.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll find out, hopefully.
Lost like tears in the rain.
Yeah. Why such fervour? Why such fury? I mean, I think the theory is that there was a tradition in Liverpool of street preachers. That would be something that they would have seen as teenagers, you know, going into town. There were, you know, that they were there with the sandwich boards on and declaiming loudly in a Scouse accent, the dire warnings from the Old Testament.
Yeah. But it was clearly a specific guy, and I think it's going to take Mark Lewisohn to find this guy, the original preacher that inspired Lennon.
Well, he found Mr. Mustard, so if he can find Mr. Mustard, then he can probably find that, yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I watched Magical Mystery Tour this week in preparation for this, and what's interesting about Magical Mystery Tour is I think Paul wants to recapture that freewheelingness of Rubber Soul, but obviously once you put a camera in front of you, it just doesn't like work in the same way. But like, I don't know, it's I think Magical Mystery Tour's lovely, but I mean, I didn't watch it on Boxing Day.
So. You didn't watch it on Boxing Day in black and white, did you? Yeah. It's stuffed full of turkey. I don't know. I think it's...
With your war veteran father tuppy.
Yeah. I used to like them when they had their nice hair. But I find Magical Mystery Tour interesting, but not particularly hilarious. There's a lot of whimsy there, I think. But that doesn't make me laugh so much as A Hard Day's Night does. But even though that's not them, you know, speaking their own words.
There is a bit of Magical Mystery Tour in Big Train, I think, somehow. Very, you know, long, floating punchlines. Like the bit with the kind of the dwarfs wrestling and the... Because the blind man's buff thing, and there's something a bit Big Train-y about it, I thought. Do you think that makes sense?
Neil Innes was actually totally, he went much further than that. He said there'd be no Python, and he was really quite over the top in his praise, I think, of to be fair, he was in it, but you know. I think the problem with Magical Mystery Tour really is that despite 1,000 hours of editing, it's not finished, is it?
Yeah.
It's strange to think, actually, of all the latter Beatles projects. This isn't even in the book. This is just me, you know, realizing now. Mm. They're all unfinished. Magical Mystery Tour, there's some... I mean, why didn't Ivor get his song? There's so much great stuff they cut out. It could have been a far better... And there was going to be an animation with the wizards teaming up, and it literally, they ran out of time, you know, in a bloody dairy barn somewhere out east.
There weren't many drafts of that script, though, were there, Jen? I don't think Paul said, I'm on my 11th draft of this. I mean, basically, he had a basic idea, didn't he? I mean, that's very much the spirit of 1967, having just had some acid and a great big joint. Well, let's just get everybody together and get on the road and see what happens. And you know, it's a fine spirit. It's good, you know, especially in the days of now, of over-preparation and minuscule control freakery. It was the exact opposite of that. But, you know, you do need a little bit of discipline sometimes. So otherwise you cross the line with the camera, you know, and you can't have that.
I just think that we love it all so much, though, that we're kind of blind to that. And the very last part of Yellow Submarine was supposed to be full of them being fully animated, not just the, you know, the hole and all that kind of stuff. It was supposed to be glorious, but they just ran out of time.
Yeah.
Let it be. You know, all of these things like unfinished projects.
Mm.
And, you know, quite the opposite, I'm sorry, Kev, to what you were just saying, is imagine if Paul Jackson had loads and loads of magical mystery stuff to do something with and to... you'd still have the original. This is the thing. I just think... it's unfinished, basically. Yeah. That was one of the main problems with it.
I think that even the greatest artist in the world would have trouble making something coherent out of the rushes of Magical
Mystery. Well, definitely. It would have been a hard editing job, that's for certain. There would have been some migraines happening there. So now it'd be good to talk about Neil, too. Neil Innes, who's a major component in the book as well. Certainly a large one. And Neil Innes, of course... was the creator, originator of the Ruttles, and also earlier was in the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, who were in Magical Mystery Tour. And he was a fantastic songwriter and guitarist and pianist and vocalist. He meant a lot to the Beatles, and the Beatles meant a lot to him. There was a big link there.
Well, this is the, you know, part of the whole thing. The book is dedicated to Neil. I'm sure there will be a far more an actual proper celebration of Neil as a book form. Will be fantastic one day from the family, maybe. But the thing about Neil, as we all know, is that he was just too nice, you know, wasn't he? He was just such a friendly bloke.
Yes, he once said to me, he said, I haven't got the sharpest elbows.
Yeah, that's pretty bang on. But he had friends all over the place, and I wouldn't claim to be one, but we'd had many a chat because I'd seen him so many times. And he was quite passionate about this, the whole fact that the Beatles had never been looked at as comedians. And he was, you know, well, the videos are all up on YouTube and everything. We sort of talked about this. And we were going to have a big proper interview, and sadly that never happened. So I mean, Kev, I always had in mind to write a lovely foreword. And we were talking with Neil about having an afterword. He was going to sort of send a kind of postcard from somewhere and do it that way. But don't blame me. I know it may look like I'm a Jonah, but I went through this with Humphrey Littleton with my very first book. It's suddenly, oh my gosh, this living history has now become something else. I mean, the book is dedicated partly to my mum and dad, and to complicate matters further, I actually lost my dad last year as well. But my dad was exactly the same age as John, my mum was exactly the same age as Paul, and they always hated the Beatles. They just weren't interested. They just it was like too young and funky for them when they were in their 20s. They were into, you know, Slim Whitman and things like that. And so I grew up without the Beatles and discovered them myself, and that's where my passion comes from. So I got to dedicate the book to them, like it always was, and then I had to also say it is, for now, it's for Neil. And there's so many ways. We haven't had any chance to celebrate Neil's life and work yet because of this year. Yeah. And this is hopefully just the first sort of brick in the wall, if you like, of trying to deal with losing Ron Nasty, you know.
There is a plan. There is indeed a plan to get some proper big do in celebration of Neil and his life and his music. But, of course, the wretched COVID thing has stopped us all because there are lots of people on it with the assistance and cooperation and blessing of his family as well. So maybe it might not be this year, it might be next year, but we're going to have one hell of a send-off as a stage act. As a stage night, you know, somewhere big in town.
I'll definitely be there.
And there'll be a lovely memorial at some point as well. Amazing. Because, you know, we need to say goodbye. Because he was, you know, I absolutely loved him. Mm. He was, I was such a massive Bonzo's fan and Ruttles fan. And I got to meet him and blimey, you know, do meet your hero sometimes. Because
that's exactly what I was going
to
say.
He was a delight to be with, you know. He was just a warm, fuzzy, just bundle of sort of non-malignness, you know.
I mean, he should, in terms of sort of raw talent and what he achieved and what he means to people, he's very underrated. But then I suppose if you are that, you've got that kind of personality, you're always going to be a cult figure. But what he means to the people that do love him is 100 times more than, you know, is that famous thing that David Quantick says of there being more love in the room at a Ruttles gig than at a Beatles gig and stuff. And one of my great sort of life regrets is never having seen the Ruttles. Oh. Would have absolutely, I mean, I just imagine it would be such a joyous experience.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And I saw him probably three or four times. And what was good about it was that he had mates with him. So he was still enjoying it very much. And there was on drums, John Falsey, who I've met before and is absolutely hilarious. He's the funniest bloke. And they had such a good banter between them. And so when he was doing that, you know, I think it got harder doing tours, sort of the older you get, obviously, and it can become a bit grueling. The Ruttles songs were still sounding fantastic, and he got a group of musicians around him as well.
Hell of a lineup,
and they just sounded great. They just sounded. I didn't care how many times you hear those Ruttles songs; they still give something a bit new each time.
Yeah,
you know? And you know, Love Life, I think I like actually more than the song it's based on. You know, really just love.
I think it's amazing the attention to detail, isn't it, in all of those songs? I think. I was thinking about With a Girl Like You and If I Fell, where it's like there's
I generally prefer that one too.
Do you? Yeah. But there's like this 2-bar phrase which is in If I Fell, and he does it, but it's like the other way around. It's like so kind of like
it's
neat,
really,
you know?
Clever, isn't it? I mean, the way he's he's satirized a harmony, which is that's something.
But he's one of those people like with Bonzo Dog Doodah Band for me, it's where I first realized music on its own could be funny. You know, my dad played me Gorilla. And, you know, the jazz, disgusting, hot, delicious, cold?
Yeah.
Or is it delicious, hot, disgusting, cold?
I want that played at my funeral.
Do you?
Yeah.
is it the clarinet solo or something? It's like, I just couldn't breathe when my dad played it to me. It was just like, I thought it was going to...
We had our first kind of a tiny little taste of that making the jingles for this podcast, and then you realise, actually, it's very hard to sound like the best band ever. But he did it, and to a schedule as well, that was quite grueling. Yeah. It's just, you know, absolutely amazing.
Still, it is fun to ruttle a song if you can manage it, though. Kevin, have you ever ruttled a song? I'm not sure. I like some of your songs. I'm obsessed with comedy music, as the book suggests.
What do you mean ruttling a song? Give me an exact...
Basically, have you pastiched the Beatles musically?
Have I pastiched the Beatles
yourself as a songwriter?
I did. No, do you know what? I have tried. I have tried stand up wise, and I tried to do a Beatles song just with rude lyrics, which isn't a very intelligent idea.
I've done it as well.
But musically, and trying to get the chords and the melody line, and you just think, I know I can't do it. It sounds like Freddie and the Dreamers. It doesn't sound like the Beatles. There's something indefinable there that I couldn't get, which makes kind of, you know, Innes you know, you just think, well, he really did. They really did. A lot of them did sound like actual Beatles songs. I've tried a few times. I find it very hard.
And to get that John Lennon voice so right is, I mean, it obviously helps when you've got the studio techniques, but you write in the book about how Cheese and Onions especially has been ended up on a load of Beatles bootleg albums, and for years there were people that and as someone who grew up in the Napster generation, I have a lot of kind of bootlegged like Radiohead songs that it turns out are just not that bad, but you know, there were people who up until, you know, a few years ago would have thought that was a genuine like lost classic.
Yeah. Some of those bootleggers were stretching, though, as well, because the same can be said of Dudley Moore and Peter Cook doing LS Bumblebee, which doesn't, you know, wasn't supposed to sound like the Beatles and doesn't sound like the Beatles, but it's still, oh, John Lennon wrote that, definitely.
Yeah, there are the rumours in the show. Yeah.
Neil did a fantastic John Lennon voice, and he didn't do the original McCartney voices, did he?
Ollie Halsall.
Yes, who died very sadly. I think early '90s.
Early '90s, yeah.
But when it came to doing the archaeology, I think he took over doing Paul as well. Neil did, didn't he?
No, well, I think the beauty of it was that they did have some Ollie Halsall recordings which got used in archaeology.
Oh, right, okay.
So there was that beautiful it sounds terrible to talk about beauty when it's somebody's death, but both the Beatles and the Ruttles were working with recordings of their dead bandmate when they came together to do that stuff. But I think Neil stuck to Ron only.
I just love the chewing gum is just always a thought, you know, when in Love Life. That's such a great little note, isn't it?
Yeah, Lennon was a big gum chewer as well, and also Neil did a very good Ringo as well. That was excellent as well. Yeah,
was it? It might be David Quantick again. He said that you know, living in hope is better than. Don't pass me by.
Oh, yes. I agree.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
It's a low bar, as Beatles songs go.
Yes, I mean, Shut Up Your Face is better than Don't Pass Me By, isn't it?
Again, yes.
So you write about this a little bit in the foreword, Kevin, but when did you, I mean, you're a musician as well as a you know, actor and comedian and writer, but what was your first exposure to the Beatles? When did you sort of get obsessed with them?
Well, it's because of my age. I actually was born at a time when the Beatles were about. I was born before that because I'm 60. So as I grew up as a kid, the Beatles were a part of the backdrop, and they were there. So they'd always been there, which is kind of weird because for a lot of people, you know, sort of 40-year-old or something, by the time they're born, the Beatles have already been split up by 10 years. So they always see them as legend. So I was brought up with them as part of the sort of sonic backdrop, which was absolutely fantastic. And I loved them. I'm always sort of slightly wary of those early memories not having been constructed later, but I keep coming back to this memory of the kitchen, and there's the transistor radio is up on the side of the kitchen, and I'm just looking up over it, and this sound's coming out of it, and it was "I Want to Hold Your Hand," and I specifically seem to remember going into that middle eight, and when I touch you, D minor seventh, and it just it playing me, and it just absolutely just sending off fireworks in me and getting my heart. And then, so they were always there all the way through. And then the movies came on, and they split up, and then the movies came on, and then I went through all of the you know, the glam rock stuff, which was as a teenager, that was the thing then. And Beatles were kind of uncool in the early 70s to a certain extent. And then about 76, I got into my first band, and the two other guys in the band were massive Beatles fans. And in 1976, all of the singles were released en masse. it was a really weird thing. In fact, we're talking about Mark Lewisohn, and I was actually just texting him just before we came onto this, just to say, why did that happen? It was something to do with possibly the 67-76 contract coming to an end, and, you know, whatever is the ramifications of that. But suddenly there were about 12 Beatles singles in the charts, and they released Yesterday, which was never a single in the UK, so it was released in the States, and I think it got to number three or number two. But it was on Top of the Pops. You just see all these singles, and that's kind of where I was thinking, oh yeah, I remember these from when I was a kid, and some I hadn't even heard because there was some of them were Beatles tracks, and I just. That was when I fell in. I fell in love. I fell down a Beatles pit, and I've never crawled out, and I never want to crawl out. And suddenly, I was writing in biro all over the place. Beatles rule, okay. And I was obsessed. I was obsessed at how beautiful it sounded, and the story. I started reading these books. This is about sort of late 70s when the books started coming out. The Shout was quite a big one for quite a while. And you suddenly saw how there were these four guys and their very interesting lives of childhood, particularly Lennon having gone through all these things, and that adventure through just being this dossy little, you know, punk band, never finding a drummer, and then getting that break in Hamburg, and then it all starting to go really weird and it all going off. And I've just always found it really, really seductive. And as I got more into it, I started hearing about how they recorded stuff and how they wrote stuff and all the stuff that was going on with them, between them personally and individually. And it's always just absolutely fascinated me. And I just keep finding something new in the music all the time. And I still do now. And sometimes I have to give myself a break. I'll give myself a break for a couple of months and I think to myself, do you know, maybe this piece of chewing gum has lost its flavour forever. But then I'll hear the first chord of A Hard Day's Night and I'm in there again. I just think, God, these guys are fantastic. So they've been a constant throughout my life. There's not a day I don't think about them or probably play them. I play them sort of most days. It's almost unhealthy. but you know, they've been such a source of joy to me. And they always will. That's it. They're with me to the end. I love them.
It's funny how you have that story, because we've kind of grown up in a post-anthology world where the official story is kind of arrives in 1995 or whatever, and then all of those books that you go back and read that were written before then, they kind of have either been contradicted or whatever. But I'd actually would much rather have lived in a pre-anthology world where you could have all of these sort of conflicting sort of stories and the rumours and stuff.
Just the mystery, basically.
And the mystery,
There was mystery before. Yeah. But, I mean, there's still mystery in discovering all this stuff for yourself anyway.
Yeah.
But
And the order with which people find it, I always find really interesting, because we grew up at a time where all of those records were available, but I still grew up with my first real Beatles record that I listened to being that slightly odd rock and roll compilation, and then sort of piecing together bits of the narrative. But in terms of where I'm going with this is, in terms of the story being the most amazing thing, and how All You Need Is Cash, the Ruttles film, did such a good job of, it's basically distilled the anthology into an hour and 10 minutes. And it's so freakishly on point. I know that they, Neil Aspinall, sort of helped out in that.
The thing about the Ruttles film is that it's a spoof of something that nobody's ever seen.
Yeah,
the whole
thing.
It is the Long and Winding Road. It is the original anthology that became the anthology. Mm. It's a direct spoof by Eric Idle of that, having sat and watched it with George. And nobody knows what that film was like. If there's ever a cut of it existing somewhere, I don't think anyone's ever seen it. So it's strange that... it works without the context. This is the funny thing. And then when Eric Idle did Ruttles 2, which I'm sorry to bring that up so soon, but he was, again, he was spoofing a really specific American Beatles celebration documentary thing that we'd never seen.
Okay, that's why it made zero sense to me.
It was literally shown once on like a cable channel that Eric Idle happened to watch in LA, and he kind of based it on that, apparently, so he says. Okay, so it's the first one stands alone without knowing what it's based on.
But it's interesting how the story gets retold. I was thinking the other day about the Great Simpsons episode with the B-sharps. I mean, that does a really good version of the story as well, isn't it?
And I was it is the greatest story ever told, it's understandable, really.
I was going to ask you, Gem, about, you know, because you're a big Blackadder man. I always remember at school there being a rumour after Blackadder goes forth that there was going to be a fifth series that was set in the 60s. And do you know much about that rumour and whether that would have been a Beatles story? You know.
As I understand it, that was all Rick Mayall bullshitting a tabloid journalist.
Oh, really? Okay.
He thought it was really funny to have bold Rick be the drummer. I mean, it wouldn't take much for Ben Elton and Richard Curtis to want to do the Beatles because, as we see, they are both pretty obsessive about Beatles themselves.
Yeah.
So maybe, the Goes Forth party, they talked about this stuff and Rick was talking out of school, but that was the original source. It was Rick Mayall saying that would have been awesome and I could be in this band and be a regular and stuff. And it's just, with Blackadder, things just get regurgitated more than any other comedy show in history because they're quite private about these things anyway, so the slightest rumour gets turned into...
It was literally something my dad had heard in the pub, I think.
There's a lot of them. I mean, I mentioned it just for completion's sake in Fab Fools, but I think Richard Curtis was awaiting the deep dive of yesterday, really.
Right.
We only have one stock question on this show, and I'll ask it to both of you in turn. So, Jem, do you have a controversial Beatles opinion?
I think the truth is, this book is absolutely full of them from start to finish. I mean, the very ethos of the book, which is a little bit cheeky because, you know, the music is what comes first and we love to know about their lives and the men and everything, but comedy has been underplayed. So with Fab Fools, we're really coming out batting for comedy. But because it has been undervalued, my controversial opinion generally is the Beatles were comedians, and that was that was the X factor, because the music was the best there was, but at the same time, we didn't have, you know, Freddie and the Dreamers wowing them at the press conferences.
No.
It was the one thing that really pushed them, I think, to the phenomenon that they were. So that's a kind of a large overriding one, but there's probably about another 70 or so littered throughout the whole book.
It's good. But
Didn't you cover in the book, Jem, the fact that about 66, did McCartney say that they were thinking of just leaving the music and becoming comedians? Because I've heard that quote.
Well, was it after Hard Day's Night? Or maybe after they did the Shakespeare sketch with the Midsummer Night's Dream stuff. I think there was an interviewer who asked John about Ringo especially. I think it's because Ringo had done so well in A Hard Day's Night. He said, is he going to give it up and become a full-time comedian? And John said, well, he's only saying that because he'd rather be doing that when he's doing this, and he'd rather be doing that, but we'd be crummy comedians.
Yeah. Mm.
John really always downplayed the quality of his wit any time he was actually called upon to comment on it.
I think that's an interesting point I was going to mention, which is because obviously your book's about comedy, so I think the idea of sincerity is really important to the Beatles. Like that, there's a great anecdote you say where Paul tried to cover Are You Lonesome Tonight at the Cavern? And everyone just pissed themselves because it was like, he was, you know, just trying. It was like
trying to do something really sincere and earnest. Yeah.
And there's a bit in Let It Be, all the way at the other end of the career, where he starts singing Long and Winding Road, and he obviously sees maybe John taking the piss out of the way he's singing, and he sort of turns it into a crooning version of it. And I think that's it's that balance between comedy and, you know, Paul and John wanting to put their heart on their sleeves, but, you know, that kind of scouseness sort of
it's
stopping
always
them,
there.
You know. Yeah. So it's kind of this battle between comedy and sincerity.
And I think his reaction to, I think all of the Beatles were broadly loved the Ruttles, but Paul was the only one who was slightly sort of miffed by the scene where Eric Idle's sort of doing composing
it's
a really
I
bad
love.
Song.
Today is our wedding day.
Yeah.
It's you I love. Today is our wedding day. For you always I will wait.
Well, I think it was Neil himself that said that Eric was just a stiletto heel in the jugular there, as opposed to everything else being sort of... I mean, you could say the whole Yoko Nazi thing is pretty bad, really.
Yeah.
And yet she loved it.
Nasty, meanwhile, visited an exhibition of broken art at the pretentious gallery Soho. The art exhibits had all been dropped out of tall buildings and then put on display. Amongst the little piles of rubble, Nasty found the artist herself. Chastity, a simple German girl whose father had invented World War II.
I found watching it again the Brian Epstein bit's a bit uncomfortable.
Leggy Mountbatten.
Yeah, that's very much of its time, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's sort of... it's not. It's just a little bit sort of sneery, isn't it?
Mm.
It's kind of... But it's that kind of, oh, yeah, he was, you know... He was gay.
Yeah,
you know, that's a very sort of very 1978 kind of attitude. Yeah, not very enlightened.
Yeah.
But I mean, but still, it's a good gag. Instead of having him die, as he accepts a teaching post in Australia, that's that is funny. And yeah.
So, Kevin, moving on to have you got a controversial Beatles opinion?
It's not very controversial, but I'd find Help the film a bit irritating.
Mm.
Well, it's more than irritating these days, isn't it? This has been one of the problems I faced in writing the book. And you can see why it's never really had the massive Blu-ray, Help anniversary thing, because head in hands, really, sitting through a lot of those Eastern religion scenes, you know. And it's kept vague, but even just writing in the book, the Oriental thuggies and all that, it's just...
Yeah,
it's completely non-PC. It's got, you know, Liam McKern's blacking up, and but it's a long, long, long time ago. But still, but apart from that, it's just it's a bit aimless, and again, very kind of whimsical.
Yeah.
I don't think they were that into it. I mean, they were just into having their joints and, you know, doing a bit of skiing and riding around on the bikes. I think they liked that.
Yeah.
But I don't think they were that contracted into what passed as a script at the time.
I think it's my least favourite Beatle era, the Help record. I like the early stuff because it's so interesting how quickly they moved. And then I can sort of skip over Hard Day's Night and Help and then land on when things get really interesting. But do you have a favourite era that was always your favourite?
Yeah, Hard Day's Night and Help.
Yeah.
No, I do. Yeah. I mean, I love that period. Yeah. I mean, Help's maybe not my favourite, but you know, Rubber Soul is... It's absolutely amazing. But I know I can find great beauty in every single one of the albums, actually, and they're all they're all brilliant in a different way to me. I can't pick a favorite. I can't pick a favorite album, let alone a favorite song.
Do you feel like they influenced you as a comedian as well as?
I don't know if they did. There must have been some kind of unconscious influence. Because, you know, I'm so immersed in them.
I think maybe one way John Lennon influenced all sorts of entertainers was just the way that he could do cartoons and poems and rock music.
Yeah.
And he kind of, that was quite unusual, I think, at the time. And I think it sort of showed a lot of comedians that, you know, you don't have to specialise in any one thing.
Yeah, good point.
I was really interested about the Joyce connection because that Lennon said when he first read Joyce, he said he'd found Daddy.
Well, yes, he loved the imagery. He loved the anarchy of the language, didn't he? And you can see that direct influence there from him.
Yes, yeah.
And
But he only read a few pages of Joyce, though, he said himself. Yeah. And I kind of believe that in John. I mean, he'd sit down and read the entire Sherlock Holmes when he's stuck on a boat with nothing else to read. But I think when he said, people said Joyce and they gave him books on Joyce, and he said, I read a few pages and I dug it. But yeah. He said it was relentless. He went on for pages. It's just like, it's
but one of those, there's a great, I mean, very famous Joyce quote, which is, I've put in so many enigmas and puzzles that it will keep the professors busy for centuries, which is almost exactly what John said about I Am the Walrus, which is that he was kind of deliberately taking the piss of, like, putting in all these kind of mad illusions that didn't make sense. He thought people would be puzzling over, you know.
They thought it was hilarious. That's the good thing about the humour of them, because, you know, bigger egos would have been completely puffed up by the idea that, you know, people were writing treatises on them and things like that. He thought it was ridiculous. And so he thought, well, okay, then I'll take the piss out of them, make up stuff and see if they can write an essay on that, which is very funny.
Yeah. It is.
And they're still writing them now.
Yeah. But that's one of the things I remember when I was at uni and was reading Joyce. It was like this, like, mad revelation where you kind of realize, oh, he's taking the piss. You know, it's all like a bit of a piss take. And, you know, that's where there is a connection, whether or not John read much Joyce. But, you know,
most of the best art is. Really,
yeah. Yeah,
like, have you ever read Joyce's naughty letters?
Yeah.
To Nora Barnacle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something quite Lennon-esque in the way that he uses the profound and the profane.
They are quite funny there, because there are ones where he's actually clearly drubbing as he's writing, and then when he kind of reaches conclusion, he kind of carries on. Oh, and by the way, can you go to the shops and get me some tomatoes? You know, just this, like, this stream of consciousness, as it were. But, like,
a stream of what? Yeah. Do we know for a fact that it was, in fact, multitasking?
Yes. Like Anthony Hopkins in Fist of Fun.
Who's ever got all the way through Ulysses, though?
Me,
you have.
Yeah.
I think I've tried four times, and I think once I made my eyes automatically scan the pages to the end, so that I'd got to the end. But
on the very last page, it says, "Well done, you are clever. Yeah. You have finished Ulysses."
There's an amazing book called The Bloomsday Book, which is by Harry Blamires, I think, and that's about 200 pages long, and it tells you what's happening in Ulysses. And when you read that book, The Bloomsday Book, you can read Ulysses and go, oh, I see.
That's a good tip. I might go for that.
It's excellent, yeah. What's nice about the book as well is, you know, the Samuel Beckett thing. There are so many kind of what-ifs.
I thought you were going to bring up that somehow from Joyce. It was like in my mind since you said that. Yeah. It's a real strange one, that, as well. Yeah. I mean, it's totally been accepted. You know, it's in... I've first read it in a different Beatles book. So it seems to be totally real, and it happened, and it's kind of documented that it happened, but the text is up on a website, and there's no way of tracking down the original. Mm. It was like a fanzine that existed for 10 seconds in 1973. Jesus. And you're left with this dialogue between Lennon.
But there are so many brilliant. Like, the other one I found amazing was Joseph Heller submitted a treatment for Yellow Submarine.
And didn't Brian throw it away because he didn't like the colour of the folder? It was purple, and he's just like, I'm not looking at that.
Crikey.
And Joe Orton, of course.
Joe Orton, yeah.
That's almost the heart of the whole book, that was. That was one of the great joys of writing the book, actually. I went up to the University of Leicester and got to sit with the original script of Up Against It, which...
Fantastic. Was it an actual Orton script typed up by him, or...?
Have you read the book? Because there was a screenplay that was published decades ago for Up Against It.
No.
But that was the script that had already been adapted for the second attempt to make a film of it, with Ian McKellen and Mick Jagger, supposedly, as the two main characters, which is why you have these two main characters, McTurk and Lowe. And the script that I went up to Leicester to see was still McTurk 1, McTurk 2, McTurk 3, McTurk 4. Mm. And it was literally John played Ian McTurk, this character, and what would happen is that the camera would move and you'd see these four guys standing behind him, and they were literally four people in one.
Right, it was like a split personality thing, right?
Yeah, so Paul would be McTurk 2 having this scene over there, and it was almost unfilmable, really. But nobody has ever seen those scripts before, really. I mean, certainly that means they've never been published or shared in any way. And I love the 1997 BBC Radio 3 version of Up Against
Damon
It.
Damon Albarn.
And Leo McKern and all, just the most incredible cast. Mm. But going back to the original screenplay and seeing the second version of the screenplay, that radio version has been totally rebuilt from the ground up. Mm. There's so it's unused, but you can totally see why Brian and Paul, and I think it was just Brian and Paul who even took a look at that script, both just kind of sent it straight back to Joe Wharton, and he was not happy. The thing was that Brian sent the script back to Joe Wharton, and he just said, "Oh, fuck them." And that's where the story ended. But I found a quote from a couple of days later in his diary, in the weeks before he was murdered, where he took a look back at the screenplay and said, "Actually, come to think of it, I see why they didn't accept that. But it would have been marvellous," he said.
God, that's very interesting to know that. So looking back at it, he himself knew that. I mean, what was he thinking? What did you think of it? I mean, it wasn't funny.
I've almost deliberately included some of the most unacceptable bits in the book so you can see just how bad it is.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The John Lennon McTurk character just... The misogyny in it is off the scale. I mean, it is... The misogyny in that film, had it been made, would have been like the racism in Help, but 10 times worse.
Mm. Right.
And it's... I think, as I say in the book, I remember even as a kid watching the two Ronnies, The Worm That Turned, and not finding that very funny. And it's the same idea, but another 20 years earlier than that. And just, look, women are in charge, and isn't it hilarious that the men are in dresses and the women are interested in home furnishings and nothing else. And, there'd be no way to explain that stuff away in 2020. Mm. So we're quite lucky, really, that things happened as they did.
Phew!
If we were going to do a Beatles podcast with you, Kevin, if I couldn't ask you about your George Martin impersonation, which is spectacular and has brought me much joy. And I just wondered how that happened. When did it sort of come to you that you could do that?
It was, weirdly enough, it was about a month before we started doing Big Train, and the voice just fell out. It just fell out. And I didn't think, I wonder what George Martin, and then... It felt. I thought, that's weird. That doesn't really sound like it. And then Linehan and Matthews said, when we do this, if you can do any impressions. And I said, right, I found George, actually. And they said, oh, it's George Martin. Yeah, George Martin. So they wrote the script. They wrote that sketch around that. And I found that I could do it. When Sir George died, or just before St. George died, St. George.
Yeah.
I wrote a letter because it always worried me that he'd been upset by it.
Oh.
And because I heard that he'd heard it and that he had said to someone, well, they never asked me about anything else. and I thought, God, if he thought that was mean. So I just wrote this letter to him via his agent. Just to give him a lot of love, basically, and just to say, it came from the kindest place in the world. And his agent basically intimated that he was kind of on the slide, really, and kind of not with it anymore. So I don't think it got there. But his son got in touch with me after he died. Oh. He came over for the funeral and said that he did enjoy it and it had been okay. And I was just so happy to hear that, because that was from his son.
Yeah.
And but it was weird how it just sort of popped out one day. I don't know where it came from. There was an inner George.
That's amazing.
But there was another man, we haven't talked about him. He's one of my heroes. I think there was, what a graceful, beautiful man he was,
And so
he was
funny as well.
And very, very funny indeed, and so clever. And
that was one of the key reasons for doing this book again. It was just like, no matter how you looked at it, it was just like, well, there's all this over here that nobody's done. And that's why it was heartbreaking when I didn't get to actually interview him.
Yeah.
He got me he sent me a nice letter back saying, it sounds like a good idea for a book, but I'm not sure how funny the Beatles are on the page, basically. But all of his background, he would be remembered as one of the pioneers of audio comedy in this world if there'd been no Beatles. And people like Armando Iannucci and Jeffrey Perkins and Douglas Adams and all these people who've created these fantastic comedy audio experiences, they basically start off with George Martin. He was just with him and with all the goons, obviously, and with Peter Ustinov. And they were just, they were learning how to make funny comedy albums from scratch, almost. Yeah.
And all that inventiveness that he put into those comedy records, obviously, you know, translated over into into Beatles stuff. And but that's it. Always gets me that there's this sort of this dapper, suave gentleman who was an RAF pilot, or he was certainly was he on maps or something? And he was, and there he is, you know, sort of looking to a certain extent quite the square, really. But he's there mixing up. You know, day in the life, and these incredibly esoteric psychedelic songs, and there he is in his shirt and kind of tie, and he's he's tying it all together. It's just it's incredible. He was so cool. I think.
Yeah, but there's a lovely bit in it. Lovely bit in the book where you say, you know, he was in on the joke. You know, like the bit in I can't remember what song they're doing. He goes to Paul. Okay, what's the song called? And Paul goes, shit. And George goes, okay, take one, shit. You know, something like that.
Okay, take one, shit.
Fantastic.
Great. So that was the actor Kevin Eldon and Jem Roberts. What a fantastic conversation.
Yeah, that was brilliant. And I can heartily recommend Jem's book, Fab Fools. It's such a good read. And I can't believe, having read it, that we had John Ronson on the show and we didn't ask him about the fact that Frank Sidebottom, who John Ronson used to play in the band with, Frank Sidebottom used to do a cover version of The Beatles' Flying, the Beatles' only instrumental song, with lyrics.
I've never heard that.
No, I've never heard it, but Jem's got the lyrics here. We are the Beatles, there are four of us. Direct from Liverpool, we got here on a bus. John, Paul, George and Ringo, that is us. I can't picture how this goes with the melody. We are the Beatles, something like that, maybe.
Yeah.
George plays electric guitar, Ringo has loads of rings, John plays another guitar, and Paul McCartney sings. And then one day they broke up and Paul McCartney formed Wings. You know, he did. He really did. I can't picture how that goes to the tune.
Oh, I'm going to have to pull that out of the archive.
Yeah, it's probably on YouTube, isn't it?
Lovely stuff. So the book's really great. It's out on the 30th of October. You can pre-order it. And if you follow Jem and the Fab Fools account, at Fab Fools on Twitter, then it'll have all of the updates and places where you can buy it, that preferably from somewhere that isn't, you know, a tax-avoiding behemoth.
Wow. Yeah, of course. But, and also follow Jem's account, because there may be a book launch which is sort of COVID-dependent, as I understand it. But, do follow him on the social medias.
So thank you so much for Kevin and Jem for popping in. And from one of the comedy legends from our formative years to one of the comedy legends of the future, next week we've got the fantastic Al Roberts, who you'll know from Sheeps, the comedy trio with Liam Williams and previous guest Jono, and his role as Al in Statlitz Flats, which is, I think it's fair to say, one of the greatest comedy turns of the last 10 years.
Yeah, it's great. It's quite moving as well, the budding romance between him and Tash Dimitri's character. Yeah. It's great. Yeah, Al Roberts is so funny. And it was a really, really good chat. It was really interesting as well. Kind of lots of childhood memories. He listened to all the Beatles records as well before the interview, didn't he, as well?
Yeah, which is amazing prep.
Yeah.
So kudos to that. It's a really fun one. So join us next Tuesday for Al Roberts. If you enjoyed the show, please do go to Apple Podcasts and give us a nice 5-star review, because it really does help us inflate our egos, but more importantly, to helps other people find the podcast. So that is very much appreciated. If you want to support the show, you can go to personalbeatles.com/donate and do get in contact with any of your personal Beatles stories, because we really enjoy reading them. And thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back next Tuesday.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.